let grace speak truth. Restart. This is the kingdom.
You're listening to the AND Campaigns Church Politics Podcast, where you can get in-depth political analysis from a biblical worldview. We're not trying to be progressive or conservative. We're trying to be faithful Christians in the public square.
This is the kingdom. The kingdom. Yes, it is. Gotta spread the word.
With your no good AND camp, you're listening to the AND Campaigns Church Politics Podcast with Justin Gibney. That's me. And the Windy City representative, the baddest brother above the Mason-Dixon line, the Right Reverend Christopher Butler. Now, Chris, I had a little bit of drama in my house earlier this week, and I want to give a trigger warning to all those who might have kids around who still believe in old Saint Nick. Someone in my seven-year-old's class exposed Santa Claus. They revealed the truth behind the character. And when he asked me, I was forced to fess up, to claim that I was guilty as accused. And it was kind of hard for him. I think he was a little bit upset. He didn't know. It kind of surprised him. He looked at me kind of weird, like, bro, you just been telling me this and it's not real. Chris, how do you handle that? I think I handled it fairly well, but how do you handle stuff like that in the Butler household?
Well, we will have to cross this bridge one day. It is not today as it relates to and before I say this, I'm going to tell my wife to skip this part on the podcast because she listens to it in the car with the kid sometimes. So now that she's had time to do that, we're going to have to do this with the Tooth Fairy because we have affirmed the Tooth Fairy. But we've never done Santa Claus for whatever reason. I think it's because my oldest, very young, just didn't buy Santa Claus. So we've not done Santa Claus. And we haven't had to cross this bridge with the Tooth Fairy yet. It is probably getting close because the kids are getting a little bit older. So, you know, we have a good spot because the grandparents, they insist that Santa Claus is real. My wife's mother, I think she really does believe in Santa Claus. But yeah, we haven't done it yet.
Interesting. Will parents, the day of reckoning, regarding old Saint Nick comes for all of us. It came for me early. Now, his initial reaction was kind of, I was like, hold up, bruh. You know what I mean? His first reaction was, yeah, I'm going to go tell my little brother now. And I was like, whoa, hold up, man. And I just had to have that big brother conversation that's, hey, man, sometimes you're going to come to realizations that they don't know yet, that they may not be ready for, but don't be a hater. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Don't ruin it for them. Because
don't ruin it for everybody.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think he understood that, but I'll keep you posted on how it goes. He was a little disappointed, but my rule is always when you ask me about something, I'm going to tell you the truth. So once he asked, I had to fess up. So got to maintain that credibility. You know what I mean? So that's how it's going for us. Y'all say a prayer for my little guy. Hopefully he doesn't get mad one day and tell his younger brothers, but we'll just have to see. This episode, as usual, is brought to you in part by our friends at the Fetzer Institute. We are so thankful for the Fetzer Institute for becoming our partner. And again, we have some special news coming to you at the beginning of the year in regard to that partnership. But we got a lot of stuff to talk about right now, some good, some not so good. So grab your Bible, get your mind right, and prepare to think not like a Republican, not like a Democrat, like a Christian. Here we go. Chris, I must say, when I look out on the culture, one of the things I like is the trend of showing appreciation and giving people their quote unquote flowers while they can still smell them. And I want to give such a shout out to Tim Keller today. Those who listen, many of those who listen to this podcast probably already know who Tim Keller is. But just in case you don't, Tim Keller is the former pastor of Redeemer Presbyterian Church in New York City. He basically brought orthodoxy right to the middle of the capital of secularism. He is the co-founder of Redeemer City to City, where they do leadership training for Christians all over the country. Probably thousands of Christians have benefited from that. He is a true servant of the kingdom. In my opinion, Chris, a brilliant Bible-believing Christian theologian that's had a profound impact on the church and on many up-and-coming Christian leaders. In fact, I would say that he's had a profound impact on the AND campaign. As I and the other co-founders and folks like yourself who are part of kind of the building of the AND campaign, as we were trying to articulate the organization's framework, as I remember it, Tim Keller's work was always a significant part of that process, especially how he so eloquently explained the relationship and the interdependence between love and truth. And he has a quote that I use all the time. He said that that truth without love is harshness, and that love without truth is sentimentality, meaning that it's overly emotional or lacking in substance. That quote right there, I'm going to tell you, Chris, that quote blew my mind. I had never thought about it like that before, and I think that quote did so much and edifying me and helping me to apply the gospel to the culture, to apply the gospel just generally in a better way. It made me see it a little differently. I think it was prophetic. And I'd go so far as to say that the AND campaign's framework wouldn't be as clear as it is today if it wasn't for Tim Keller's clarity. And I really do thank him for that. He's not only he served on our elder advisory board. He's you know, sent messages of encouragement from time to time, and it's really just a blessing. His ministry has really just been a blessing. And again, he's helped me in my personal understanding of right theology. You know, he, along with listening to and reading guys like Dr. Gardner C. Taylor, C.S. Lewis, G.E. Patterson, G.K. Chesterton, helped me respond faithfully to a very secular progressive environment, and to do so with so much secular progressive pressure around me. And I think they've helped, you know, he's helped people do a lot. And I put him in that list of guys that I just named in a real way. He helped me respond in an intellectual and spiritual manner. And so again, I don't think it's saying too much to put him on that list of guys that I listed before, because he's had that level of impact for a lot of people. Now, Keller announced earlier this month that he had stage 4 cancer. In that Twitter post, at least I saw the post on Twitter, he said that he was thankful for a comforting, wise, and loving God, even though he didn't quite understand why he was in the position he was in. He believed and truly believed, had faith that God had plenty of reasons for what was going on, and just a reflection of his character and the message that he's been sending for so long. It's easy to say that when you're not in that rough position. When you're in that position, to be able to say it means a lot to a lot of people. Now, most of the responses to Keller, Chris, express sadness, and that's understandable, but we're also full of gratitude. The responses demonstrated just how many people who were striving to maintain orthodoxy and be faithful in the secular age. It showed just how many of those people have been blessed by Tim Keller. And so I hope that he was blessed by so many of the responses. And I hope that he knows the impact that he's had on the AND campaign, on so many people that are affiliated with the AND campaign. He has been a blessing, a very big blessing to us. Now, Chris, I know you probably probably already knew or could imagine, as social media goes, not all of the responses were positive. You don't think it would be too much to ask to just say something positive or not say anything at all, but you know, it is what it is. So, unfortunately, among some others, James Lindsay responded to Keller by basically saying that God is going to be real mad at you for what you're doing to the church. Now, given the context, Chris, and you may disagree with me on this, but given the context, that's the response, in my opinion, of a vulgar child. That's the response of someone who lacks maturity, who lacks emotional intelligence, and really who lacks a sense of decency. It's the Trumpian response to someone reflecting on their own suffering. Lindsay, by the way, which is kind of ironic, but Lindsay, by the way, is an ideologically conservative atheist. So I'm not exactly sure, Chris, what God he's talking about or what church he's referring to. I personally don't think that he has the proper standing to credibly make that statement because he doesn't believe in God or the church that many of us are talking about. Now, before I dig deeply into that, let me say this to bring some clarity. I'm okay with non-Christians critiquing the church and critiquing church leaders. Because of common grace, there are things that we can learn from atheists and others that aren't Christians. I don't think that there's anything substantive to learn in that particular statement that was made in response to Tim Keller, but otherwise, it's definitely possible. And the AND campaign has taught over and over that we must be open to learning from others, that Christians must be open to learning from people that don't have the same faith as we do or have no faith at all. Furthermore, from what I know of Keller, and I don't want to act like we have this deep personal relationship, that's not true, but from what I know of his work, from his work, I should say, he's not the kind of person that at all thinks that he's above criticism. In fact, my guess is that I can almost be certain that he anticipates criticism, appreciates constructive criticism, that he doesn't run from it or simply dismiss it because it comes from a non-Christian or somebody that he generally disagrees with. And here's the other thing. Tim Keller is more than capable of defending himself if he chose to do so. And I think that anyone kind of vouching for his character and his ministry, he would want them to do so with love, grace, and charity. I'll try to keep that in mind, Chris, as I engage his critics today, because I doubt he wants kind of this ugly mudslinging on his account. But sadly, many Christians parrot James Lindsay. The criticism of Tim Keller coming from the far left, coming from Christians on the far left, usually goes something like this, guys. Here's the criticism. Tim Keller believes systemic injustice and oppression exist. He believes and calls for social justice. Therefore, he must be left-leaning politically, and all his students and the people that listen to him are leftists. His critics would say that he basically panders to secular progressives and has pushed the church to the left. Now, in my opinion, this is a dishonest and rather flat response to Tim Keller's work. First and foremost, Keller is orthodox. He believes in the authority and sufficiency of Scripture. He has a high Christology. He upholds the sanctity of life and the historic Christian sexual ethic. How in the world do you call someone who takes those stances a leftist or a secular progressive? That's absurd. That label doesn't fit no matter how bad you want to use it. You're not listening. The left cancels people with those stances. In fact, Princeton University reversed their decision to honor Tim Keller because he took those positions. And he never wavered from those positions just to get some kind of secular recognition. He stood 10 toes down on Scripture. You can't really make those accusations, Chris, in good faith if you look at his body of work. If you look at the substance of his work. But as Proverbs 18:2 says, fools find no pleasure in understanding, but delight in airing their own opinions. His work has actually helped me and helped a lot of others that I know poke holes in secular progressivism. It's helped me more than any far left commentary see the errors within our culture's leftward shift. He explicitly criticizes progressivism on a regular basis. I don't know if folks are closing their eyes or closing their ears to those instances that happen quite regularly. but they don't show up in their analysis. But here's what I think the problem is, Chris. Here's the problem with many people who are on the far left that call themselves Christians. Believing in the authority and the sufficiency of Scripture, having a high Christology, and upholding the sanctity of life and historic Christian sexual ethic aren't enough to be considered a real Christian. Those biblical standards are apparently insufficient. For them, you can't just be biblical, you must also be sufficiently ideologically conservative. Tim Keller's problem is that he's not ideologically pure. He doesn't check all those boxes. He doesn't hate the left enough. He doesn't talk tough enough or harsh enough to them. He's too nice to them. He actually takes their points into consideration and doesn't treat liberals contemptuously. In their view, that's his sin. By admitting that there's systemic racism in our country, Keller is a heretic because he's refusing to adequately protect their idol. And for many of them, their idol is a romanticized version of America and American history that must be held completely blameless and be referred to as existing without blemish. To say that institutional racism exists is to say that their idol is errant. It's to say that America isn't necessarily better than every other country at all times and on every single issue and in every single way. How dare someone make that implication? And let's be clear. Keller isn't someone who goes around gratuitously attacking America. It seems to me that he's thankful for what America has gotten right. But by critiquing it on racism, he's become pariah to some on the right. You see, Tim Keller also says terrible things like same-sex attracted people can go to heaven. How dare he apply the gospel to people who are broken just like us and say that if they faithfully seek the kingdom, Jesus's blood is sufficient for them too. How dare he say that? You see, the sect of Christianity that's determined to disparage and discredit Keller is the sect that everybody's running away from. How dare people in that situation accuse him of hurting the church? It's the sect that loves only themselves and the romanticized version of America that they've imagined in their heads. They love a God made in their own image, and how dare Keller suggest that that image doesn't accurately reflect the God of the Bible? These are the folks who blame the poor for being poor, who tell black people just to get over all the history and pull themselves up by their bootstraps. I would ask anyone in these groups, anyone who's disagreeing, because the thing is, you can disagree with, we don't agree on everything, right? It's not that you agree on everything, but to label somebody a leftist, to say that he's pulling the church to the left, just isn't justifiable. And it means that folks aren't listening. And we need to do better, especially after that kind of post. But Chris, I'm going to pass it to you and get your thoughts on this.
Well, you know, I think first off that it is good and right. You know, after Keller making the announcement that he made about his health for the Church Politics podcast and campaign to speak well of his work and his ministry, because as you have so rightly said, so many of us who are thinking on these things and not only thinking about them, what I appreciate about Keller is that he did live and develop theology while practicing on the front lines. And as you said, you know, the capital, maybe the global capital, but certainly the United States capital of secular progressivism. And so those of us who are not just thinking on these things, but actually, you know, having to lead from pulpits, having to lead in communities, have depended on Keller's work. And it is so good and it is so right. And I just want to join my voice to yours, Justin, and the chorus of voices that have so rightly in these recent days celebrated Tim Keller's work. You cannot overstate the blessing that he has been to the church, especially those of us who have to practice orthodoxy, not just as a matter of sort of thinking at a sort of esoteric and philosophical level, but actually think it through so that you can practice it and pastoring real people and having real political debates and shaping real organizations. Could not say enough about the thinking, as you said, the clarity of thought and speech that I believe God used Tim Keller to bring into the church this blessing that is greatly needed for the day. For anyone who would come behind any of these examples, and what I try to do is try to think about how I would behave if somebody who I really, really disagree with on a lot of things were in a similar situation. And for this, you know, I have in my mind, you know, some of the people who I just disagree with a lot. And I would like to think that were they facing a terminal illness, I wouldn't take that moment as the one to critique them, right? The moment and the tweet and the time where they're announcing to the public, because they're public figures, that they're facing that sort of challenge. That's not the moment for critique. It's unkind. And while we've sort of lost this in the body a little bit, I would just remind us that you don't have to really go past that because it is unkind, and unkindness is unchristian, right? And just because you disagree with somebody disagreement is not necessarily unkind. Confrontation is not necessarily unkind, but coming into a moment like that when somebody is reflecting on their own suffering, on, you know, facing and grappling with the reality of their own mortality, that's just not the moment to sort of bring up your critiques, whatever they may be. I agree with you, Justin, that the idea of calling Tim Keller, you know, some kind of leftist is not even intellectually solid enough for me to like really devote a lot of energy trying to engage that. It's so obvious that anybody who is familiar with Keller, familiar with biblical theology, would hear those arguments, and if they were familiar with it and wanted to have, you know, a good and fair reading of the situation, the argument just can't hold water that Tim Keller is like a radical leftist. That doesn't make any sense if you read Keller or listen to his sermons. But even if you believe that for whatever reason, but maybe that's where you are, even if that's where you are, this is just not the moment to sort of bring that portion of the conversation to the fore. If you don't have something good to say, that would be a perfect opportunity to just don't say anything. You don't have to come on the Church Politics Podcast with Justin and Chris and start talking about how great Tim Keller is. We think he's great. That's what we think. If you think he's horrible, you don't have to get on your podcast or anybody else's. You don't have to go on your Twitter or anywhere else and say that he's great. It's a perfect opportunity to just don't say anything, to come out and use that moment just to be straight up mean. I mean, it's unkind. And, you know, Ephesians 4 tells us to be kind to one another and tenderhearted. And that is not in keeping with that sort of guidance. That's not just in Ephesians, but throughout the scriptures.
Yeah, I mean, then you have the part of just holding other Christians to standards of ideological purity, right? Because again, this isn't about theology. I mean, you may have some theological differences, cool, right? You can voice those. Perhaps this wasn't the moment to voice those, but you can voice those. I think he expects those to be voiced, and he knows he's challenging something, so he doesn't expect nobody to respond to him. But this is about ideological purity. This is the reason that you have a conservative atheist that agrees with you perfectly on what you're saying about Keller, because what he's saying ain't about it's not about theology. Don't we get that? Like, if he agrees with you perfectly and has the exact same critique, what you're talking about is not about theology. It's about ideology. It's about that purity. And you want to make sure that he's ideologically pure, along with even secondarily, maybe even with the theological stuff. That's problematic, because even as we speak, I think he's doing a good work. You can tell that he's pushing out these messages that folks really need to hear, that are putting challenges out there. As we speak, he's challenging theologically conservative academic institutions to wrestle with thinkers like James Cone and other more progressive thinkers. Not because they will change and agree exactly with what the man's saying, but so that they will know what he's saying. And so that they'll be stronger in their beliefs, because they'll actually be able to defend it, because they've read people who are going to challenge what they think. Now, to me, I thought that was the perfect purpose of academia, but maybe not. Maybe I'm getting something wrong. But these are the type of challenges that he put out there. But just because he tells you to read somebody that is progressive doesn't mean he's telling you to think like them. He's saying expand what you read so that you can truly understand your position. Nothing that I have ever read from Keller has told me to be more secular progressive. Nothing. And I've read most of it. I've read nothing that made me feel like I should be less biblical or less orthodox ever. And so we need to be clear about that. And again, I want to just end this on a positive note, because he's done so much and is continuing as we speak to do so much for the church. Thank God for Tim Keller. We don't have to agree on every single thing, but I know that he works in good faith. I know he's trying to be as faithful and as much like Jesus as he can be. And that's something that I will always support. And I appreciate that, the support that he's shown for the AND campaign. I'll let you end it there.
Yeah, I mean, I just think that ideology and theology are things that we really have to work on, because we've come to this place where they are fused together. They're all mixed up, even though they are not the same thing. And the fact is that there is a way to be ideologically conservative and be faithful. There's a way to be ideologically more progressive and be faithful, because there are very conservative impulses in the scripture, and there are very progressive impulses in the scripture. And we are actually helpful to one another when we can push one another and challenge one another and sharpen one another as it relates to how to be faithful in those particular ideological spaces. For those who do have to do ministry in New York and live Christian lives in New York, in Chicago, in Atlanta, in D.C., you know, you might say that Keller is hurting the church because he told somebody to read Cone. But I will tell you, if you're trying to reach middle class and professional class Black folks and you haven't read Cone, you may come off sounding unintelligent, uninformed, and have that much more of a difficulty really reaching people. Now, we know that ultimately it is the job of the Holy Spirit to convict, to convert, to save. But keeping yourself from listening to and understanding what other people are thinking, just because, you know, you disagree with what they're thinking, I think puts you at an intellectual and a relational deficit, because it's also relationally discouraging for me to just dismiss, you know, what this person who I'm trying to talk to, who I'm trying to build with, has read, the way that they have been thinking. The same way if somebody told us that, you know, I don't believe in Christianity, I haven't read the Bible, I haven't read Keller. I haven't read, any of the sort of Christian thinkers. Haven't read them. Don't read the Bible. I just don't believe in what you're talking about. We would say to an unbelieving person who was taking that approach, you know, maybe you need to be better informed. So those challenges to me are the very types of things that I feel like when engaging with Keller, those are the things that have actually strengthened my ministry. Those are things that have actually strengthened my ability to do the things that God has me doing. And again, I would say if that's not your thing, right? Because that's helpful to me. That has sharpened me and made me better. I know that it has. Doesn't mean that that's your thing. You can totally not do any of that. Never read James Cone. Never do any of those things. And you can still be faithful, go to heaven, be a good Christian. But there's just no need to attack somebody else for not doing it exactly the way that you do. There's so many things that are core and fundamental to what we believe. And I just pray for a day in the church where those of us who actually have agreement on those core and fundamental things can understand that there's room in the world and room for the church for folks who have other sort of ideological bents.
That's a word. We will be right back on the Church Politics Podcast. And we are back on the Church Politics Podcast. Since we're talking about defenses in a way, I want to talk a little bit about what should be defended and what shouldn't be defended. Chris, it never fails. In almost every interview that I do with white evangelical groups that is about on the subject of justice, that I'm asked about my opinion on the Black Lives Matter organization. And I generally think that's a fair question since the AND campaign is in the social justice advocacy space. And people want to know where we agree and also what makes us distinct from Black Lives Matter. I get that question. On the other hand, and I'm sure you've experienced this too, some folks just want to hear us attack Black Lives Matter. And I make a point of not feeding into that. I'm not your weapon. You can't use me as a sword to attack other people of a color on demand. It's just not going to happen. And it's true, we're not aligned with Black Lives Matter on some issues. But I think it's very important to acknowledge that if it wasn't for Black Lives Matter, generally, many Christians and many Americans would still be ignoring a lot of racial justice issues. I believe that to be the truth. In many ways, Black Lives Matter forced those who were trying to ignore the issues to address those issues, and I am thankful that they were able to do that. They did that in a way that was just, we've been talking about impact. It was just an impactful way of forcing the issue. And I'm thankful that they forced the issue in ways that very few other groups, including the AND campaign, have not been able to force it to that extent. And I think we'd be remiss not to recognize that. That secular organization did what needed to be done in this moment. They did what many churches and many leaders in churches refused to do. So before we render any type of critique, may we not forget that important fact. Now, again, that's why we don't get lured into attacking Black Lives Matter on request. That's something that we're just not going to do just because somebody wants us to do it. I know some people would find that entertaining, but that's just not who we are. Now, that said, Chris, I also would say that we'd be remiss. I think we would be wrong and unfaithful if we refused to critique any group when a critique is necessary. I don't think we can be partial in who we scrutinize. Some Christians who value social justice like we do seem to have resolved not to ever criticize Black Lives Matter or any other secular justice movement at all. not to ever say anything that might be a critique coming from a more biblical standpoint. It's almost as if critiquing them would give credibility to anti-social justice Christians. And I understand where people are coming from, because within the culture war, to critique one side is to support the other side, or at least that's how the story goes. But I disagree with that perspective. Understand it to some extent, but I disagree with it, and I think it's actually harmful. We shouldn't be picking fights or attacking folks just for the entertainment of conservatives. But it's also wrong to reserve important critique that needs to be heard. This is why I think it's important to call out Black Lives Matter, the organization, for a statement that they made in support of Jussie Smollett. As you all probably know by now, Jussie Smollett was found guilty in Chicago of perpetuating a hate crime hoax. The story he told police and the story that he told the public was one of the most shameful and ridiculous stories that I've heard in a long time, but a lot of us believed it because it fit our narratives. And that's unfortunate. Now, prior to that verdict coming out, Black Lives Matter released a statement saying this, and this is only part of the statement, but I want to read this part out. In our commitment to abolition, the abolition of, I guess, the police, we can never believe police, especially the Chicago Police Department, over Jussie Smollett, a Black man who has been courageously present, visible, and vocal in the struggle for Black freedom. While policing at large is an irredeemable institution, the Chicago Police Department is notorious for its long and deep history of corruption, racism, and brutality. From the murders of Fred Hampton and Mark Clark, to the Burge tortures, to the murder of Laquan McDonald and the subsequent cover-up, to the hundreds of others killed by Chicago police over the years and the thousands who survived abuse, Chicago police consistently demonstrate that they are among the worst of the worst. Police lie, and Chicago police lie especially. That's a very strong statement. And let me start my examination of it by saying this. The Chicago Police Department has earned much of the skepticism that it receives. Let's be clear about that. Now, I don't know, you know, the murders of Fred Hampton and who did all that. We can have those conversations. But they have earned much of the skepticism that they have. But to say that we can never believe police officers in any circumstances is wrong. We're with you. We say that the system needs to be reformed. Well, we're not with you. I guess we're different. You're saying that the system needs to be abolished. We would say that the system needs to be reformed. What we can agree on is that there needs to be change. But to say that you could never believe the police in any situation over somebody because of their identity is just an overstatement. It's something that becomes absurd if you try to take it to its logical conclusion. There are still police officers who are doing good work. What we need is not an abolition, but what we need is to make sure that there's due process rather than just assuming that everyone on a certain side is lying. Society can't move forward in that way. I'm disappointed that they used their platform to speak out on this issue in this way. Now, they had the right to do it, but it was a bad idea. It did not serve the issues or the people that they represent well. They took part of their hard-earned social capital, and I think they squandered part of that on something that is really pure foolishness. And it's regrettable. To invoke the names like Fred Hampton and Laquan McDonald for this, it's just a bad look, man. Because, Chris, Jussie was trying to manipulate the public based on an issue that people throughout history have shed blood to change. And he was doing it for nothing but his own vain self-interest, his own vain benefit. That should not be defended based on some type of identity solidarity. There's no solidarity in that. It damages the movement, and we have to be more prudent. I always try to keep in mind as we make decisions, and I know you do the same, that the movement doesn't belong to us. That to the extent that we do have some influence, we have to steward it with principles and with the people who are hurting in mind. You don't gamble that kind of capital away on such trifles. And so I think for an organization that has done much to bring to bear the issue of race in America and has done some good and was much needed and has done more than most organizations, especially in modern times, on the issue of race, that was a mistake. And so after saying all that, I still will say Black Lives Matter, but I want to hear what Chris has to say on the matter too.
Yeah, I mean, I don't remember if we just talked about it and, together, if we actually talked about it on the podcast. But from the very, very early days of this, when the attack was first announced, I was very skeptical of the whole situation. The idea that somebody got attacked up on the north side of Chicago, by guys walking around in MAGA hats, challenged me. It challenged what I know about Chicago, having lived here all my life. And so I withheld a lot of, jumping in on this, even in the very early days, because it seemed fishy. And as you said, this is real. Like, throughout history and still today, there are actual hate crimes that take place all the time. People being physically harmed and sometimes even killed because of the hate that other folks have in their hearts. And so to try to leverage that for personal gain is, that's detestable. That is a horrible thing to do, because it does provide an argument for folks who do want to say that hate crimes don't really take place, that, that we're past all that, that that's not part of America anymore. This gives an argument to folks who want to say that, that maybe we shouldn't believe it when it happens. And so what Jussie Smollett actually did was damaging to the experience of every person who may actually fall victim to this kind of hate crime. So then to turn around and defend it, for anybody to do that, is a little bit crazy in my view. But as you said, for Black Lives Matter, who have developed some social capital, I will say, and influence in social justice spaces, organization has done great work, and that movement has done great work. That's another thing that folks here in Chicago can testify. The work that they did caused me to discuss repentance on the part of the church, that it took a secular organization to pour out into the streets and be completely fed up with the situations that we face in terms of how police interact with communities of color all over this country. So that work has been done. That work is great. To leverage that on something like this is just really bad form, in my view, because of the seriously gross offense that's created here. And the last thing I'll say, and I say this gingerly because I'm not aware of everything that everybody has done. And I'm not aware that everything that Jussie Smollett has done before the case. But this statement holds up a person. It seems to speak of a person who is deeply engaged in the struggle for justice. And it seems to me that the biggest fight that I've witnessed is to defend not the cause of justice, but just one's own personal reputation, career, et cetera. And so I think it's really unfortunate that that this statement came out. I think it's more unfortunate that the organization has stuck by the statement. And I think it highlights for us the danger of leading with this sort of identitarian politics where I can't criticize you because of your identity, or that like this whole idea that like the Chicago Police Department like cannot produce anything good ever at any point. Like nobody in the Chicago Police Department can ever tell the truth. There's so many complicating parts of that, right? Like I have great, faithful, Bible-believing African-American Chicago police officers in my congregation. So, you know, this whole idea that the Chicago Police Department cannot produce, you know, a true statement ever because of the real legitimate trouble and sort of troubling history and some of the present difficulties that the police department faces, to take that and say, oh, well, they can't produce truth ever. Like nobody there can ever produce anything true. It creates the same kind of difficulty. It produces the type of situation where one of those police officers actually in my congregation was working a protest and had a white protester called him a chocolate pig in an anti-racist protest. And it's like, this is why that identity piece and that sort of, making it a zero-sum sort of identitarian political world, it's dangerous. And it is quickly going to get you to the place where you start, I mean, just denying reality and common sense.
And you lose so much credibility. To sit there and say, when one of the biggest lies that we've heard within pop culture, that's, you know what I'm saying, that we've heard in a while, to sit there and say, because he's black, he has to be telling the truth. Bro, nobody's going to believe anything you say after you say stuff like that. To say that no police officer can ever tell the truth, when people have had their lives saved by police officers in Chicago, when police officers have given their lives recently for the city. It's a flattening of reality that allows you to have complete contempt for a whole group of people without even thinking about it. And any Christian who's afraid to say something about that, who's afraid to say, you know what, this is unacceptable because this is how you create hate. By saying that a group of people could never be honest, could never tell the truth, could never do the right thing, but my group always tell the truth and always must be defended, even when it's a blatant lie. To me, this is the height of kind of that opposition center politics, that identitarian essentialism that says they're always evil and wicked and we're always good, even when it's obvious to anybody that's halfway working with in good faith to see that's not the truth. Everybody nobody was convinced by that statement. And I'm not going to speculate as to how a statement like that comes about at that moment. But just know that it's not a good look for the movement, for the organization, or anything else. And when we're not willing to speak up on it because we think, oh, this will make the folks who hate social justice look better, then we're not helping. Then we're just losing credibility. We're not hurting them by not telling the truth and not speaking up on something when it's obviously out of line. We're hurting ourselves and the people that we say we're here to help. Take us out, Chris.
I mean, I just add my amen to that. It's unfortunate. And the lesson I would point out for us is that we have to avoid that in the church. We have to avoid that in our own sort of ideological spaces that each of us occupy. Whoever you are, listen to the podcast. Don't get to that place where it's only about identitarian politics, where it's only about ideology and who's ever on my side is right by virtue of the fact that they're in the right trap.
Don't defend the indefensible, Christian, even if it's in your tribe. We'll be right back. Are you too progressive for conservatives and too conservative for progressives? As a Christian, do you find yourself feeling politically homeless? If so, then you're not alone. Listen, this is Justin Gibney, president of the AND campaign. And if you're a Christian who doesn't know a whole lot about politics or someone who knows a good deal about politics but wants to be more faithful in the public square, then you have to read the AND campaign's book, Compassion and Conviction. The AND Campaign's Guide to Faithful Civic Engagement that we publish with InterVarsity Press. Whether you just want to understand the relationship between church and state, why Christians should engage politics at all, how Christians should engage partisanship, politics and race, advocacy and protest, or even civility, this is the book for you. It's very much Bible-centered. It's Bible study and small group friendly. There are questions and exercises after every chapter that give you a framework for engaging politics in a biblical way. So if you want to do it in a better way, get our book, Compassion and Conviction, the AND Campaign's Guide to Faithful Civic Engagement. And we are back on the Church Politics Podcast with Justin Gibney and the Right Reverend Christopher Butler. Now, last week we had a conversation and we said, hey, look, one of the things that we're going to try to do on this program, especially starting next year, but we'll just, you know, we'll get it going a little bit now, is when, you know, when we put out an opinion, our opinions are not infallible. If you haven't noticed, our opinions are not inerrant. When we put out an opinion, if you're part of our Patreon family, if you disagree and you make a pretty good case, we will let people know what you had to say on the show and address what you had to say. I think that's the best way to go about it. We're not trying to hide from criticism. We're not trying to act like we're perfect. We want to hear what y'all have to say when there's a disagreement. I think that's part of a healthy discourse. And so last week, in the last episode, Chris and I had aimed some criticism at American pharmaceutical companies for refusing to release the patents to their vaccines. We felt, quite frankly, that it was greedy and generally immoral. Poor countries are getting lesser vaccines because these companies don't want to give away the recipe even after getting money from the government to create these vaccines. Even after President Biden said that he would push them to give away this information. So we had a problem with that. And we got a couple folks, not a whole lot, but we got a couple folks who hit us up on Patreon and disagreed with our take. One of those people was Peter C. And this is what Peter C. had to say. He said, I have some pushback on the vaccine patent talk for you. He said that basically these vaccines require such specific inputs and manufacturing processes that even if they did make their recipe public, no one would be able to do anything with it for many months or even years. Instead, what we should be focusing on is helping the companies find partners to license out to create more supply. It seems they've done a decent job with that already. Consider ways to increase supply, for example, smaller doses for boosters or no boosters until the global vax rate is higher and so on. And he says he said lower regulations that are preventing or slowing new vaccines from getting to the market. It's important we remember that there are more vaccines out there that work well besides the big three here in the U.S. First and foremost, Patrick C., thank you for sharing your perspective. We appreciate it. We want to continue to hear it. So thank you for that. It sounds like Patrick C. is basically saying that it'd be almost impossible for others to manufacture the vaccines, even if they did release the patents. So the world would be better served if these companies focused on finding partners to license it out and create more supply. Okay. I don't disagree that it might be good to form partnerships and to create more supply. But I will say that I think this argument altogether, and this is the argument that obviously some of the manufacturers and pharmaceutical companies have been making, I think this argument is pretext. I think it's not the actual reason that they're not going to release the patents. While manufacturing the vaccine might be difficult, I'm not going to disagree with Peter there, does that justify fighting against patent waivers? Does that justify maintaining your ability to keep your recipe secret and sue others for infringement? It seems like two different issues to me, related but different issues. Because I think that you can address the manufacturing difficulties without keeping your patent secret. Plus, the World Trade Organization and others have called you to release the patent. And I'm sure they understand the manufacturing difficulties just as well as you do, or just as well as other experts do. I just don't buy the argument. It sounds like they're trying to find a related but different issue to cover for the fact that they just want to maximize profits. Because you can find partners, you can find other ways to get that done without saying, no, but we got to make sure that we don't give any waivers on our patents. That's two different things. You could do both at the same time. But by not doing one, by not allowing your patent to come out, not allowing the information to come out, you make sure that you are maximizing the profits. And so that's why I say it sounds like pretext, because one thing doesn't stop you from doing the other thing. But while they're giving us additional reasons, they're still not releasing the patent that really, in my opinion, should belong to some extent to the American people in as much as we paid a lot for it. Again, we said last week, we don't have a problem with them making profits, and they're in the billions and billions of dollars of profits on this. But it should be for common cause. It should be for common usage when you have a global pandemic. And I just don't see how the manufacturing issues is a reason so that they should be pushing against the waivers. Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, I mean, I think I take the same view. One, many thanks to Peter C. I think this is really awesome to do it this way. And I'm grateful for the response. I think it is important to understand that there are these other things that you could do. And I couldn't agree more with Peter C. on the idea that we should certainly be thinking about, is it the best thing to do, to be vaccinating 3-year-olds and giving, 25-year-old healthy people 4 and 5 boosters before we make sure that the global community has better access here? I agree with all those things. But as you pointed out, I just don't think these two things are mutually exclusive. If my thinking is you don't know how to use it, what's the harm then in putting in the waiver? Folks in South Africa certainly think that they could do it if they just had the details. So what we have to assume then, and this is, I think, where it gets a little bit difficult for me, is that these manufacturers seem to want us to assume that, no, we actually know more and are, superior in some material way to folks in South Africa. If you have this idea that they don't understand the supply chain, they don't understand how it's actually done, and even if we gave them the recipe, they won't be able to do it, then what's the harm in giving them the recipe? We put in the waivers and we get right to work on supply chain issues. How do we make licensing more streamlined? How do we certainly, I think that there needs to be much more conversation around, how we're doing boosters and who's getting vaccinated multiple times and all that stuff. And in the light of the global situation, I agree with all of those things. I just don't think the waivers are, mutually exclusive from any of those other thoughts. Put the waiver in and get right to work on all the rest of it.
Yeah, none of those explanations explain why you should be fighting against waivers. None of those explanations explain why you're preventing anyone from having that information. Now, if it's true and they can't manufacture it and that's a problem, then you might be proved right. But it really doesn't justify you making sure that nobody else has that information. The only thing that really justifies you making sure nobody else has that information is a profit motive. Right? Is because you want to make sure that you have something exclusively that people have to pay you for and you can maximize profit. So if that was a justification, I'd see what, and I called him Patrick once, but it is Peter C. I see what Peter is saying, but I think that that just sounds like pretext to me because, it, like you said, it's not mutually exclusive. You could provide the information and do all the things that you mentioned, but you can't provide the information and sue somebody for infringement or maximize profits. That's where the problem seems to come in. Well, I want to thank everybody for listening to this episode. As usual, ANCAMP, there is a cross that neither political conservatism nor progressivism is fit to bear. There's a civic hearing in need of faithful witnesses who love social justice and won't surrender the truth to be loved by the world. Politic with the boldness and compassion of Jesus Christ. Until next time, ANCAMP. Well, I'll let you.
Oh, Lord, I say kingdom.